This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, President Obama defends the Iran nuclear accord. China detains a group of tourists for reasons unclear. Drought raises the risk of HIV.
We found kind of a surprising result, which is that the more drought an area has had recently predicts a higher level of HIV prevalence in that village.
Controversy hits a country western music icon. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. President Barack Obama says he expects U.S. congressional debate over the Iran nuclear pact to be robust, and he said it should be. At a White House news conference Wednesday, Mr. Obama said the contention by some opponents that Iran should have no nuclear capability, not even for peaceful purposes, is unrealistic.
You'll hear some critics say, well, we could have negotiated a better deal. Okay, what does that mean? I think the suggestion among a lot of the critics has been that a better deal, an acceptable deal, would be one in which Iran has no nuclear capacity at all, peaceful or otherwise. The problem with that position is that there is nobody who thinks that Iran would or could ever accept that, and the international community does not take the view that Iran can't have a peaceful nuclear program. They agree with us that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. And so we don't have diplomatic leverage to eliminate every vestige of a peaceful nuclear program in Iran. What we do have the leverage to do is to make sure they don't have a weapon. That's exactly what we've done.
President Obama says there will be real consequences for Iran if it violates terms of the deal, including reintroduction of economic sanctions scheduled to end if Tehran adheres to the deal it agreed to after months of negotiations with Britain, France, Germany, China, Russia, and the United States. Will the nuclear agreement lead to greater dialogue between Tehran and Washington? That's the question International Edition's Jeffrey Young put to Middle East Institute senior fellow Alex Vatanka.
I think it would be not only smart thing to do, but perhaps even the essential thing to do if you want to keep this nuclear agreement alive and something that exists beyond the Obama presidency, which ends in 2 years' time. What Iran and the United States need to do is to look to build on this nuclear agreement. There is so much that divides Iran and the United States that one single historic agreement, as important as it is, the question is, will it be enough to keep them together for the foreseeable future? I mean, remember that the lifespan of this agreement is 10 years. If you want to keep it alive for 10 years, you've got to start building on the political confidence. And that is the hard work that needs to start sooner rather than later.
There are people who look at the situation in Yemen, who look at the situation in Syria, and say, can we, should we even begin to engage Iran on these issues? Aren't they on the other side of what's going on here? What is your sense of that?
I mean, that's a justifiable question to ask, because there is so much bad blood going back 36 years to 1979, and it's going to be almost impossible to overturn that in any quick fashion. But if you're realistic about it, you want to sit down, you want to look at where you are in the region. And there are issues where Iranian-American interests overlap, most obviously, notably in Iraq with the fight against the Islamic State of Daesh. The Iranian-Americans are already, in effect, fighting the same fight against that terrorist organization. And then if you can do that convincingly, you can go down the list and perhaps even pick up more challenging conflicts that Iranian-American interests could again work together.
And, of course, there are people who will stand up and say, wait a minute, what about Robert Levinson? What about Jason Rezaian? There are American nationals who are being held by Iran, and we haven't seen much movement on that. And there's people on the Hill who keep raising that, too, and say, why do we want any agreement with Iran whatsoever until we get these people back?
You know, I would say people are absolutely right in asking those questions. What the Iranian system is doing right now in keeping some of these dual nationals in prison on very dubious charges, if not trumped up charges, you have to question that. And again, it goes back to that debate inside Tehran today. What is Iran going to be from today onwards?
Alex Vitanka, Middle East Institute Senior Fellow, speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Continuing with Iran, International Edition's G. Abby Lee is in the studio to tell us about the reaction to the deal on social media. Hello, G. What are people saying about the nuclear agreement on the web?
Hi, Ray. For today's segment, it's more about who is not saying about the deal than who is. As you know, it's been more than 24 hours since the Iran deal was reached, but leading presidential candidates from both parties are not commenting on the issue.
Well, that's interesting. Can you specify who they are for our listeners?
Absolutely. It's the former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side and the real estate tycoon Donald Trump from the Republican Party. Clinton has been tweeting on a wide range of issues from immigration reforms to wage hikes, but hasn't said anything about the nuclear deal on Twitter. And same for Trump. He has been replying to TV personalities and media, but he hasn't mentioned the Iran deal at all.
Well, what about the other presidential hopefuls? Are they busy tweeting anything?
Yes, and some are definitely more passionate about the issue than others. For example, Marco Rubio has been very prolific and critical of the deal on Twitter. Jeb Bush, who is trailing right behind Trump in polls, tweeted that the deal has legitimized Iran being a nuclear threshold country. Bernie Sanders, who is quite a lot behind Clinton, tweeted Tuesday night that the deal is a victory for diplomacy over saber-rattling. But he didn't post any additional tweets on the issue Wednesday.
What about the public's reaction so far to President Obama's speech on Wednesday?
Well, Ray, I would say a lot of people were tuned in to the TV speech and the Q&A session. Iran was one of the top 10 trending topics on Twitter Wednesday, and that word was used in nearly 600,000 tweets worldwide. And the social media analytics website Topsy shows hashtag Iran deal was used nearly 57,000 times in the last 24 hours. Ray?
Thank you for the update, G. That's social media reporter G. Abby Lee. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's spelled J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays, on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. China arrested 20 foreign tourists who were traveling the country. The tourists were arrested at the Erdos Airport in China's Inner Mongolia. According to a statement by the South Africa-based disaster relief organization Gift of the Givers, 11 of the tourists have been released. The organization says 9 others remain detained without charge for watching unspecified propaganda videos. Imtiaz Suleiman is the chairman and founder of the Gift of the Givers. He spoke to International Edition Sarah Williams about the controversy.
Well, the information we have is that they were arrested last week Friday at 9:40 a.m. China time. They were touring the country. It was a 47-day tour package organized by a company called China Odyssey Tour. They were into day 30 of the tour having gone through several cities in the country, when they were stopped at Erdos Airport, which is in Inner Mongolia. Their phones were confiscated. They couldn't contact the South African embassy and the British embassy. The group comprised 10 South Africans, 9 British, and 1 Indian national. So none of them could contact the embassies. They couldn't contact the family members. They couldn't contact the tour operator, and they couldn't have any access to any legal person. It was only on Sunday, 48 hours later, when the tour operator found that his group was arrested, that he then started calling the family members related to these 20 people. And it is at that point that one of the family members in South Africa asked me if I can assist. And I normally do get involved in international relations issues because I have a very close relationship with the South African government, and I have a humanitarian organization. We are the largest disaster agency on the African continent, and we've been involved in 42 countries in disaster projects. So they asked me. I involved my government. They went out on Monday night. They flew from Beijing to Inner Mongolia, met the Chinese authorities, and were trying to ascertain what was the reason for the arrest. No clear explanation has been given.
Okay, because I had read that the reason was they apparently were watching some sort of what the Chinese government was calling propaganda videos in their rooms.
Yes. Now, they provided three reasons. The first one they said is they think they have some information, or they know, or they have a suspicion that one of the group members has some links to terror organizations somewhere in the world, but no clarification was given on that. Then secondly, they were told that somebody belongs to some banned organization. Is the banned organization in China or somewhere outside China? If it's outside China, how does it affect Chinese internal politics? And thirdly, and the most strangest one, was this, that some of the family members or group members were watching propaganda video. What is this propaganda video? How does it affect China? We don't know. They haven't produced that evidence at all to say these are the videos. My only understanding is this, that since someone in that group are Muslim, it's possible they could have been watching videos or even listening to CDs on the recitation of the Holy Quran, because it's the month of Ramadan and the Muslims throughout the world increase the recitation, the hearing, and things to do with religion. And it could be that, or it could be something plain that is in praise of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. That's the only logical thing I can think of they could have been doing in the month of Ramadan and nothing else.
So what are the families going to do? I mean, and also what is the tour company? What are their plans to try to get these people freed?
Well, now the tour company and the families can't do much. It all depends on a government-to-government relationship. That's why we engage the South African government and the British people engage the British government. I don't know anything about Indian National and whether his government is involved. He's only one. But still, he's one. He's a human being. He needs to get out of there if he's innocent. But the South African government has engaged the Chinese government. The South African deputy president is on a state visit to China with a whole group of government ministers and deputy ministers, together with a business entourage. And we are calling upon our government to stress upon the deputy president to stress and deal directly with the Chinese high authorities to say, look, if you have a case against the citizens of my country, produce the evidence, bring the proof, and charge them if you have any such thing. If you don't have any proof or any evidence, then don't hold them in custody, release them unconditionally, and let them go back home. And that's what the families and we are calling for the deputy president to do. What the British are going to do, I don't know, and what the Indian National is going to do, I don't know.
My colleague Sarah Williams speaking with Imtiaz Suleiman, the chairman and founder of the Gift of the Givers. Officials in the northwest U.S. state of Alaska have launched an ambitious new phase of their cleanup of the state's massive shoreline, including hundreds of tons of tsunami debris from Japan's 2011 earthquake. The operation, including funding from federal and state resources, as well as a $5 million donation from Japan, will include a barge and helicopters picking up debris already stored in super sturdy sacks above the high tide line. The debris includes remnants of docks, fishing buoys, refrigerators, building and boat fragments, and shipping containers that have all been washed or blown ashore along thousands of kilometers of U.S. and Canadian shoreline. Officials say it's created an unsightly environmental hazard affecting marine and land wildlife. Janice Stewart of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation told VOA's Victor Beatty the location of cleanup operations is a result of the taking of thousands of pictures by aerial survey along the coastline. And she says identifying what may have come from Japan depends largely on the years of expertise of marine debris contractors.
They had been doing debris work for a number of years, including prior to the tsunami. And their experience indicates that in the years following the tsunami, there were periods of time on certain beaches where more than 50% of the debris that was coming in was tsunami-related. Now, it's difficult to identify individual objects, and NOAA, which is administering these funds, has very specific criteria for identifying objects that are tsunami. You have to be able to prove that the object was at a site in Japan prior to the tsunami and then can be specifically identified when it's on the beaches. So there aren't a lot of items that are have gone through that rigorous certification, but because of the nature of the debris, particularly oyster buoys that are common to Japan and were common in the area where the tsunami came through, certain types of foam and that are used in Japanese construction, some of the later arriving debris, the heavier debris, is Japanese dimensional lumber, which is identified because it's uniquely different from American dimensional lumber.
The tsunami was 4 years ago. Has this all been collecting since then, or have you had periodic cleanups?
There have been periodic cleanups for a number of years. They haven't all been funded with this Japanese gift money.
Are any Japanese officials or cleanup crews involved, and will any of the Japanese-related materials be returned to Japan?
The only items that have been returned to Japan have been individual items that appeared to have either personal or cultural or historical value. There was a soccer ball that was found that was able to be sent back to the school where it came from. There have been some small individual items. There have been a number of Japanese folks who have come over and have worked on as volunteers on some of the crews. We did receive some gift funding from a consortium of Japanese engineers who basically put out a tip jar at a conference in Japan, and individuals contributed funds.
How much debris are we actually talking about, and how long will this process take?
This particular barge process is going to be about 1 month from the time it lands in Kodiak until the time it reaches Seattle. The debris that's being picked up in dozens of locations has been collected over this year, last year, and a few places the years before.
So this is all heading for Seattle for sorting, recycling, and disposal?
That's correct.
Disposal in Oregon, is that what I understand?
Yeah, the waste management, the final waste management disposal facility is in Arlington, Oregon. So the debris will be offloaded at the Duwamish River site, on the waste management site in Seattle. It'll then go to a sort line where some nonprofit organizations are going to try to do some sorting and selecting of the debris that can be used for recycling. And then the rest of it will all go to the final disposal site in Oregon. We don't have landfills in Alaska that can handle this kind of quantity.
Janice Stewart of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA News.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? They're called rate-actuated straps, and they could dramatically decrease brain injuries, the kind American football players suffer. Eric Wetzel is with the U.S. Army Research Laboratory.
So we envision integrating these straps with the head system so that before the head strikes the ground, the straps will slow down that head motion, sort of like a shock absorber.
These straps are made with a viscous fluid that allows the straps to remain flexible at low velocity contact with the helmet, but they become far less elastic with higher velocity contact.
It's this elastic material that has this very special property that if you pull slowly on it, it's easy to stretch and it relaxes again, but if I jerk it quickly, it resists with much more force.
Once this technology is available to athletes, the trick is to get them to actually use it.
It also has to be comfortable to wear. You have to be able to put it on and off quickly, and frankly, it has to look cool.
For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossons.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. Could savings accounts reduce the spread of HIV? New research finds that buffering people from financial hardships may keep them from resorting to risky behaviors that spread the virus. VOA's Steve Barragona explains.
Few people in the developing world have much in the way of savings.
When they have a bad week or a bad month,
they often don't have any way to cover themselves.
Study co-author Kelly Jones is an economist at the International Food Policy Research Institute. She says financial bad news often comes in the form of drought in rural sub-Saharan Africa, where most people depend on agriculture. She and her colleagues compared rainfall patterns over the previous 10 years to HIV rates in villages in 19 African countries.
We found kind of a surprising result, which is that the more droughts an area has had recently predicts a higher level of HIV prevalence in that village.
11% higher for every drought. The most likely explanation, they said, was that people were coping with the crisis by trading sex for support, and that raised their risk of infection. One hint came from looking at who had the highest HIV rates, women in agriculture and non-farming men.
That does suggest some pairing of the women who are experiencing the income shock with the men who are least affected by that income shock.
There's other research showing increases in crime and political unrest following droughts in Africa. The new study expands the list of consequences, according to University of California at Berkeley economist Edward Miguel, who was not part of the research.
This evidence makes the case really convincingly that these economic shocks caused by drought don't just lead to social instability, don't just lead to political instability, but also have huge health consequences.
Jones says better ways to cope with those consequences could include better access to savings accounts and credit, weather index crop insurance, or more drought-tolerant crops.
Whatever we can do to help people reduce their income risk is going to have potentially far-reaching benefits.
She's currently studying whether helping vulnerable women increase their savings lowers their risk of HIV. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
There's nothing like a good spat between celebrities. It makes for some great gossip. Country superstar Luke Bryan recently made some comments about outlaw country icon Waylon Jennings that didn't sit well with the late singer's family. But as International Edition's David Byrd found out from Nikki Strong, the two sides worked out their differences.
If you're a fan of outlaw country, then the names Merle, Willie, and Waylon are just part of your everyday vocabulary. But Luke Bryan apparently had a little bit of a dispute with Merle, Willie, and Waylon, and it got a little heated. Nikki, what was the nature of this dispute, first of all, and what happened? I understand that there's been some peacemaking.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think at the heart of it is the notion of a new school artist disrespecting their predecessors.
That would be Luke Bryan.
Yes, of course. And so basically what happened, Luke Bryan did this interview, and when he was talking about the changes in country music, he basically said, and I'm quoting him, "I think that people who want Merle, Willie, and Waylon just need to buy Merle, Willie, and Waylon. I'm not an outlaw country singer. I don't do cocaine and run around, so I'm not going to sing about outlaw country. I like to hunt, fish, ride around on my farm, build a big bonfire, and drink some beers, and that's what I sing about. It's what I know. I don't know about laying in the gutter strung out on drugs. I don't really want to do that."
Oh.
Ouch. Yes. Ouch, exactly. And so fans were furious, especially the fans of Waylon Jennings, who is no longer here with us. And so Waylon Jennings' daughter-in-law in particular lit into him. And she basically said, "I hope your family members are proud of you for using your worldwide platform to take the time to disrespect my father-in-law." She said, "You have managed to prove to the world your true self, albeit that Waylon's drug use is well documented and something he overcame. I assure you, he was never laying in a gutter."
I've always been crazy, but it's kept me from going insane.
What happens is that Shooter Jennings then chimes in, and he extends...
And Shooter Jennings is who? Is that Waylon's son?
Yes, it's okay. His son. He extends an olive branch because he said, you know, Luke Bryan, once he realized how much stuff he stirred up, he called up shooter's mother and apologized.
Mm.
And for
like a good Southern gentleman ought to,
exactly.
right?
Exactly.
And
good country boy, your mama raised you that you got to own up to something
yes.
stupid.
Yes. So he apologized to her, and Shooter saying, you know, I know what it's like to misfire at the mouth from personal experience. And so, and Luke Bryan is basically saying, even though he apologized, but he's like, I just feel like he felt like his intentions were taken out of context, that he really wasn't trying to belittle anyone's legacy, but he was just saying that it was a difference in style.
Okay, well, what do you think? Are you on Twitter? If you are, you can send Nikki a tweet at @VOA_music. You can also send one to us here at International Edition. That's @VOA_IE. And you can listen for Nikki on Country Hits USA at www.voanews.com.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more stories, pictures, and video on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
By the end of 2015, the Millennium Development Goals, or MDG, the United Nations' 15-year plan to cut global poverty by half, will run out of time. So the UN is drawing up the Sustainable Development Goals program, which is meant to succeed the MDGs and to consolidate their gains. Like its predecessor, the Sustainable Development Goals program identifies poverty as humanity's greatest challenge and sets its elimination in all its forms as top priority. Other goals include the promotion of people's well-being through better health, education, nutrition, empowerment, and gender equality, to name a few. All these goals, said Michelle Sisson, U.S. Deputy Permanent Representative to the United Nations, can be more easily achieved by promoting Goal 16, the rule of law. That's because when a society adheres to the rule of law and citizens become better able to make their voices heard, society becomes more committed to living by the rule of law. But when the law is selectively applied or written in such a way as to disadvantage certain segments of society, everyone loses. For instance, most smallholder farmers are women. But in many countries, laws discriminate against women by not allowing them to inherit land, sign legal contracts, or access financial services, thus depriving them of access to needed equipment and better seeds. Changing these laws to provide women codified and equal rights to land tenure would increase food production. Studies have shown that securing and recognizing women's land rights can increase agricultural productivity and shared household decision-making, and thereby help lift families out of poverty, said Ambassador Sisson. Similarly, laws that protect civil society from oppression could help generate new ideas and encourage entrepreneurship. Laws promoting transparency would diminish corruption, improve economic activity, and restore citizens' faith in their leaders. And all such changes would support other key elements of the development agenda. The rule of law promotes respect for freedoms of expression and association, transparency, and facilitating access to justice, said Ambassador Sisson. With respect to each of these principles, freedom of expression and peaceful assembly, transparency and access to justice, the rule of law impels societies ever forward.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.